Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we present a panel discussion with a range of scholars exploring religion through narrative games. This is a special episode in conjunction with our new exhibit, Level Up, Writers and Gamers, on display now. The following conversation originally took place April 11th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
And Level Up is an exhibit about gaming and writing, which is part of our conversation for tonight. So we will be exploring the people who write narrative games, the notion of players as part of the narrative process and the writing that goes into it, and how it's influencing our culture today. For those of you who may not recognize gaming as something as a part of your life, but you know younger people who think it's important, You may not realize that the gaming industry is somewhere around $120 billion a year in revenue worldwide, and that if you take all of Hollywood and all of the recording industry and combine the revenues for a year, it's still less than half of that. So it is a huge part of who we are as a country. So with that in mind, we've pulled together a special group of people. And we also have an exhibit that is, we are working in the planning process for 2026. And that exhibit will be on the intersection of religion and writing. And we are in the early stages of that. And so we happen to have some folks who are helping us with that exhibit and who have helped us with the new exhibit. And so I'm going to introduce our panel, and they're going to talk about how these two topics intersect between religion, gaming, writing, and which we called Gods and Gaming for tonight. So let me introduce quickly. On my left right here is Emily Cruz, who's the executive director of the Martin Marty Center at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Her research explores how people's religious lives are connected to their ideas about gender, race, and the body. Emily is one of the lead advisors on a religion and writing exhibit. Right next to her is Keisha Howard, who is the creator of Sugar Gamers and an award-winning game entrepreneur. She is committed to innovation and inclusion in gaming and promotes games as a way to foster empathy, critical thinking, and personal growth. Keisha has been a key advisor on Level Up. On the far side there, Alireza Dustdar is an associate professor of Islamic studies and anthropology of religion at the University of Chicago Divinity School. His work is focused on Islam and anthropology and sociology and religion. And Genwa Hayek is associate professor and deputy dean of humanities of modern American literature and a scholar of modern American literature from the late 19th century to the present in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilization at the University of Chicago. And together, Alireza and Genwa are working on a study entitled Gaming Islam, which is a collaborative research initiative that explores representations of Islam and Muslims in video games and in the entertainment industry broadly. So, say welcome to our panel. Can you give them a round of applause? And I'm going to let Emily take over and lead the discussion.
Why don't we start by talking a bit about the relationship between gaming and writing, since that's why we're here. How can we think, maybe we'll start on the end with Alireza and then we'll come around. How can we think about the relationship between gaming and writing like poetry or writing novels, et cetera? What's the relationship between those and how do we kind of make sense of them? Is it the same? Is it different? How is that comparison enlightening?
Maybe Renwa should start answering because okay. She's the literature expert.
I think the best analogy I have for this is that I'm a scholar of Arabic literature. And in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, which is when I start to become interested in Arabic prose, Arabic is a language of poetry. But in the 19th century, people are starting to write novels for the first time. And it's a very experimental form. They're super excited about the novel. And there are models. They're educated in French and English and German. And they have these 19th century reference. And they're trying to create something in Arabic that tells Arab stories in fiction. And the thing that's really interesting is the kind of stories they start telling are, because they're also trying to sell, much like Charles Dickens was, journals, they start to tell serialized stories. And these serialized stories you know, every chapter leads up to some really tense moment, and then you have to buy the thing, you know, the next issue of this journal to find out what happens to the characters next. I mean, you're familiar with the concept, right? We sometimes get alienated from this when we read them as novels, but when we remember how people experienced them for the first time in the 19th century, we sort of get the idea. And this is a very long way of saying that when I first started playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare, which is a video game that was first released in the early 2000s, around the same time as the American invasion of Iraq, and then re-released in 2019. The first thing, and I had a really kind of defensive aversion to playing Call of Duty for the first time. I was like, this is just a shooter game and we're just gonna be like killing people and this is just gonna be awful. And I found myself incredibly immersed in the story of Call of Duty because it uses the same formal techniques, right? Every section is a chapter. It builds suspense. You're doing something new. And right at the moment of tension, the chapter ends. And then you're like, oh my God, I have to play ahead because otherwise I'm not going to be. So I think for me, form is a way to enter, to make this comparison between the novel and especially the serialized, or it was my way to sort of enter into this world of gaming as narrative, and the sort of the techniques that even the most commercial video games share with this kind of early experimental form. That was my entryway into sort of understanding this question.
So I am a gaming consumer, and I've been one since the Game Boy came out. And before then, I was an avid reader. So I am 20 years before social media took over our lives. So I got to experience gaming in a very formative way. So if you look at gaming as an art form, like for me, playing a game was like reading a fiction book that I could play, that I could immerse myself in. So if I wanted to play Lord of the Rings, or playing Final Fantasy was like reading a Lord of the Rings novel where I could play one of the characters. And like, how immersive is that experience? And when it comes to reading and playing games of this nature, there's something that's triggered, your imagination. And for really powerful stories, it becomes a cornerstone of your identity if those stories touch you. Which is why, like, gaming for so many, not only, you know, is a core identity moment, but it's also a way, in a framework, a language, that they talk to other gamers who have experienced this same experience in this like sort of fictional imaginative world, which is why it's so important to have so many different types of stories in this space, because we're all like sort of searching for that art or for that narrative that impacts us as an individual and represents us, which is why we consume the media that we consume, whatever it is. So a lot of times we just don't make that comparison of games as an art form, writing as an art form, and that being a medium of expression, and how important that is to, you know, our essential humanity. So before you get to like, is the game profitable? Is the game this? Is the game that? Why do we play games in the first place? And why do we write stories? Why do we tell stories? All of those are core things that connect us as individuals and within our community. So it's really important to like think of games expansively, especially, you know, we think of it as entertainment, but it's entertainment that influences us and also works as a medium of expression for the stories that we tell.
I was inspired to add something about what I think is distinctive about games in relation to literature, which is, of course, every game will have writers working on it, and those writers do different things. They might work on the narrative, they might work on dialogue, they might work on character building, but there's also the structure of the game and the form of the game that has to be written, and that there's a difference with novels insofar as a game doesn't just go from point A to B. There are many different possibilities for the way that a game is played out. And in narrative games, in games that have stories, the story might play out differently and might end up in different places, and your character might develop in different ways depending on the choices that you make. So the way that identification, for instance, works with the playable characters or other characters in the game very much depends on the decisions that you as the player make inside the story while you're playing the story in a way that just is not, I don't think, possible with novels, or at least with typical novels. You know, there are, I remember reading these Dungeons and Dragons style books in the 1990s, like late 80s and early 1990s, where you basically read with dice and paper and pencil, and you had to sort of make certain decisions as you read the stories. So one game that I used to play in the 90s was called Conquest of the Longbow. It's still one of my favorite games of all time, about Robin Hood. And, you know, it sort of had the standard Robin Hood story, but also you got to make decisions. Like, you really needed to take on a beggar's garb to do a certain mission and learn some things within Nottingham. But then the way that you acquired the beggar's garb was up to you. You could either pay money to a beggar on the highway to give up his clothing and then make friends with him, or you could threaten him and take the garb by force. And the way that you acted impacted the rest of the story. And I think it's really interesting to me also as someone who was playing this as a teenager, and I grew up in revolutionary Iran, and sort of Robin Hood had a really significant place in my imagination. It was the Disney version was played on national TV every spring, every Nowruz. There were certain things that were changed, like King Richard wasn't in it because he was the champion. Because it was an anti-monarchist revolution. But you know, playing it, it was really sort of, for me, it was like aspiring to be a Robin Hood type character. So also it wasn't just game, like playing, it was also a certain kind of spiritual and ethical sort of moral development type of exercise, even if I might not have imagined it precisely in those terms.
Yeah, so if you were someone who played that game and you beat up the beggar, you should be reflecting on yourself. I should admit from the outset that I am not cool enough to play video games. Those are not my types of games. I'm amazed by people who plot them, who know them. I am much more interested, well, at least much more capable, when it comes to things called role-player games, a lot like what you were describing, or RPGs, they're often called, and probably the classic or paradigmatic one of those is Dungeons and Dragons. So this is where a bunch of nerds get together, you dress up in cloaks, you pretend you're different characters. So I also came to this game through Lord of the Rings, that's where my interest came from, growing up being a reader of fantasy. Also not an unnerdy pursuit, but one I'm very proud of. And I think the thing that I find most interesting about those games is they're inherently about storytelling. That's what you're doing when you're playing them. You have a lead person, often called the dungeon master or the DM, who crafts the overall structure of the story, but then everyone gets to think about who they are. You get to build a character from the base. You get to decide what kinds of strengths do you have, how agile are you, how creative, noble, ethical are you, and then you work in community with other people to craft a story about how your person behaves. And there's some, it is a game of chance in the sense that you roll a god-awful number of dice, and you have to figure out how to play based on those things. So you can get tripped up and it can be complicated. So you have to make decisions like, do you attack or do you wait? They're inherently about deciding beginning, middle, and end. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Are you going to have an anti-hero? I think that the narrative structure of D&D is really what draws most people to it. That and that you get to wear cloaks. Yeah. Not that I did that. I never did that.
Can I add one thing to this?
Please.
Just to sort of tie everything together, I think a lot of experimentation in prose fiction over the past 100 years is about precisely how close can you get to a self, right? To a subject, you know, sort of, and you see the transition from the sort of third person perspective to the narrative eye. And like one of the really interesting things about gaming, whether you're in a space like Dungeons and Dragons is that the narrative eye and the playing eye become one. Right? There's no, like, when I die in Call of Duty, I die, right? It's not, oh, my character died, right? Whereas when, for example, a character dies in a novel, it's like, oh no, one of the little women died, Is it Beth?
Beth.
Right? It's like Beth died, and you feel sad for Beth, but you're not Beth, right? Whereas what gaming collapses the narrative subject in a really kind of interesting way that sort of opens up to questions of its potential for helping you see sort of more abstract kind of metaphysical and spiritual kind of narratives and experience them.
I always sort of wanted to be Beth because she was so honest and pure, and I was definitely Joe, sort of unruly one who was always reading.
Everyone wants to be Joe, right? They're just like the only good character, yeah. And she's the most sympathetic character.
Right, and no one wants to be Meg or Amy. No.
Or Amy.
Maybe this is a quiz that will follow.
It's like the 19th century Sex and the City, who am I? Yeah. Oh, wow.
Gaming, as we've just, you know, shown in this little bit of the conversation, is huge. It's expansive. There are all kinds of games, all kinds of people play it. So let's narrow in a little bit toward the specific focus of the night and talk a bit about gaming and religion. What are ways that you can see representations of how you think about religion in gaming or the influence of them on one another? Yeah. Ollie Rose, why don't you start this time?
Should I start? Okay. Many, many, many different ways. I think there are games where you literally can play God, and there's quite a few of those. So, you know, you get to build a society and experiment with it, and sometimes your role is described quite literally as God, and you can do acts of God, like bring, either send blessings or send chastisements. But then, it goes all the way from that to exploring, say, stories where religion figures in some role, sometimes more minor, sometimes more major. I think maybe more stories than maybe are productive or about fanaticism, where religion does come in, and I think that it shows certain blind spots in the way that narrative around religion is composed and assumptions about religion, and we can get into that if people want. Something else that I find interesting with religion is the way certain atmospheres are crafted in some games, where there is an attempt at least to produce a certain kind of spiritual experience, for lack of a better term. So there was a game called Journey, for instance, from, I want to say, a bit over a decade ago, which really became famous for this. It's there's no dialogue in the game. You're basically this one robed character. You never see the character's face, and you're running around these expansive vistas towards a destination that is not clear to you, and there's no explanation given for where you're going. You can't die in the game. You can't really fail. And those vistas include mostly desert-style vistas, but then other types of vistas as well. And I remember reading on Amazon some of the reviews for the game, and some people were describing weeping as they played this game because of the way that it made them feel. And I played it myself because I was, I'm interested in religion, and I could see why this would happen. It's a very calming type of game, but it also it does this really nice job of creating a sense of transcendence through light, through sound, through a sense of space and vastness. And your movement through the vastness. So the way that you just sort of are able to slide down, say, desert hills, and then all of a sudden fly through the air in a kind of almost a limitless fashion. There's no, God is not in it. There's no direct reference to any religious ideas or doctrines or beliefs or anything like that, or rituals even. And yet it seems to do some work that we associate with certain kinds of religious practices and experiences. So really a wide field. And then on the dark side, we were just talking about this briefly, there are also games where you are put in a role where you can literally crucify somebody to a cross. And, I think you can be crucified yourself also in some other games, but you're essentially put in the place of a kind of an executioner or torturer, and you can choose to do it or not, but the game actually allows you, if you want, to follow through and with all the gory details. And what work, of course, each of these games does very different kinds of work, and some of them do multiple things depending on what choices you make, or even at once.
Yeah, religion in games, in my experience, it links to the fact that, to your point, games as a transcendent experience. A lot of people think that the fun part about playing games is that, like, the game is inherently fun, like all the parts are fun when you're pressing the buttons and all the other good stuff. But no, that's not really what happens. You have a simulated experience of anxiety, frustration, challenge. No matter like what type of game you're playing, it's usually a simulation of something that we're sort of engaging with in real life, whether we put that into a fantastical or our fictional space, or you know, a historical space, or what have you. We're creating a narrative, but as you said, where games collapse the space between, you know, the immersion between yourself and the character you're playing. This is where video games really can impact a person's identity around how they navigate faith, how they navigate challenge, and some of the core reasons that we explore our religious and spiritual selves. It kind of simulates a lot of those experiences. So when you win, it's meaningful if you go through this sort of character development of losing, of it being hard, of it being frustrating. You're trying to get past a level, there's some anxiety. And then on top of that game mechanic, if you add a compelling narrative that really, really like sort of contextualizes those feelings that you're feeling to get through to the next level. Again, it simulates the kind of exploration that we have when we're in that introspective space calling on God, however we look at that, or calling on our faith in something that's beyond our physical understanding of the world, which is why these fictional stories that we play in games, or you know, the representations of the stories that we're navigating are so important and can be so impactful because they're touching at something very human about all of us and our exploration of self and our relationship to God.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful games I've played in the past few years is called Gris, like the Spanish and French word for gray, and it's a great game.
Yeah, it's great.
And you start playing it and you don't really know what was going on, but slowly you realize as you move up through the levels that color is being added to this world that was once gray. And then you realize that the entire game is a kind of meditation on loss. You're mourning your parent in this game that has no language and no text whatsoever. It's just visual and musical, and slowly the story, like you recreate the story and you work through this kind of grieving process with the character, but you only realize it belatedly, you know, once color starts emerging into the world and the music starts. So it's a narrative that doesn't need verbal language to express itself. It's using visual language and sound to sort of cause you to reflect profoundly on, you know, the process of metamorphosis through kind of through grieving, through mourning.
Yeah, and if I may, the games that you mentioned, Journey and Gris, I mean, I know it's probably pronounced different, but it's spelled G-R-I-S. Like, I'm just like, ooh, is that how it's pronounced? But in games like that, once you complete them, you're left with this really interesting sensation in your human body,
right,
that is transcendent almost. Right. It's like, wow, I got through something, that narrative, you know, transformed me. Even if it was for a little bit, it puts you in a completely different state of mind that books also do, and games also acts as a medium for that. So, I mean, those two games are just perfect for that.
Yeah.
God, I want to play this game.
You should.
Or maybe I don't. I can't decide.
Oh, you all should play.
No, you should. It's also quite easy if you haven't played, or, you know, you work your way up.
That's good. You know, I think role player games are all about religion in a way that we conventionally define it. So they're woven through with ideas about ritual, about myth, about certain kinds of performance, that you observe a certain set of belief structures, that you're interested in self-discovery, that there is a divine figure or sets of figures, that there is something otherworldly or other than human that's woven through the story. You're often on a journey of seeking. And so I think that's particularly the case with Dungeons and Dragons. But interestingly, Dungeons and Dragons and other RPGs are often kind of given a bad name, and especially many of you will probably remember the Satanic Panic of the 80s. I grew up in the Evangelical South. It was a bit before my time, but I am very familiar with the idea that D&D and other types of games are, that they're bad, that they're satanic, evil, or corrupted, or corruptive in some kind of way. And I think partially that's, there's something frightening about the idea that you could achieve transcendence or build community in ways that are divorced from a conventional religious structure. I think it scares people who tend to be more orthodox, or, you know, they just think elves are creepy, which they are, of course, wrong about. But interestingly, D&D is really modeled on actually multiple forms of really conventional religiosity on Christianity, actually. One influence is Prussian role player games, war games, which were about Christian dominion over certain parts of Eastern and Western Europe, the expansion of Christian empire in Europe. And then they're based on the work of people like Tolkien, who was himself an ardent Catholic, mm-hmm. who wove Christian imagery and ideas through Lord of the Rings, who was in conversation with other profoundly committed Christians. And so there's a way that it's ironic that something that is based in certain kinds of Christian modes of being was, and I think sometimes still is, so frightening to many Christians. And I don't have an answer particularly. I don't think it's good or bad, but it's worth considering what it is that feels so threatening. And I do think sometimes it is the idea that you can fall in love with a story that might not be conventionally orthodox, that might absorb you. Yeah.
Oh man, I'm so excited to comment on that.
Yes.
So like, I love this conversation, gods and games, religious writing, games. Again, if you look at writing in and of itself as a medium of expression and art as a form of exploration in and of itself, like in our narratives, we all explore these human emotions like fear and confusion and anxiety and expectation and so on and so forth. And like, I love how nice this conversation is, but we, most of us have probably read or written something that's like unpleasant to experience. And yes. And that's why games are so, like, we're not just having these transformative or transcendent experiences because everything was fun and everything was good and everything was pleasant. Like, there are some games that really explore that fear in ways that are almost even blasphemous. Like, I don't know if you all have heard of Cult of the Lamb, for example, as a game. And there are a lot of horror games that use a lot of Catholic motifs and, you know, those cliches to create an exploration of fear and horror. And like, you know, it's really interesting how like it's a game that you are exploring as an individual. But again, the transcendence doesn't necessarily have to come from a good, positive experience. And a lot of times when we're talking about games especially, we're on a moral binary, like mm-hmm. what's good, what's bad, yeah. good versus evil. And that's not what, you know, our personal explorations of our spiritual selves usually is about. It's, you know, landing somewhere that feels right for you within, you know, the context of what you're exploring spiritually. So, but it's usually not like it's black and white. It's, again, an exploration of the narrative, of the story, yeah. you know, so on and so forth. So I'm just glad that you mentioned that, because I'm like, this is going to be such a nice conversation where everyone's like, hey, you know, we love
games are so spiritual.
Nah, games yeah. violent, you know, like, yeah. like, don't you Call of Duty over here?
Yeah. No, and actually this might be a good point for Aliza and I to talk about
definitely
how we ended up with gaming Islam.
Right. Well, let me say about something else before that, which is on this issue of morality and maybe lack thereof. It's interesting to me also when games are deliberately underwritten in certain ways to allow for more exploration and mm-hmm. sort of less rigidness. And that can, it can go some morally dubious places. So in the famous Grand Theft Auto games, for instance, and I had never played, I don't know if you've heard of Grand Theft Auto, you know, I had never played them until very recently. I finally was like, okay, I'm working on games, I need to play Grand Theft Auto. So I installed Grand Theft Auto 5, which is the most recent one, And this is what's called a sandbox game, which means you're, there's a kind of, or sorry, an open world sort of sandbox game, which is it's a pretty big world. It's not completely open, but it's a huge world. It's essentially a number of cities, and you can drive through it, walk through it, ride a bicycle through it, ride boats, and so on, and interact with various what are called non-player NPCs, non-player characters, and you can do horrible things to them. Like you can buy weapons or acquire weapons, and then just randomly shoot people. But you can also do other things, like you can go on a race, on a foot race with someone. Somebody will just call you down and say, "Hey, you want to go on a run with me?" And you'll go on a run, and then you can shoot them. Or you can like play tennis with somebody, and then you can shoot them while running,
so you can win.
Exactly. Or you can pick up prostitutes, and then you can shoot them. There's a way in which there's a certain kind of reward structure almost built into it. Not in the sense that you get points, although you might actually get points. I haven't done that. but in the sense that it sort of, there's a way that it works with your brain wiring, you know, sort of just the reward of just going on a rampage. It's a sort of kind of a Freudian id type of thing, mm-hmm. right? It's like the erotic drive and the death drive together, almost all in one game.
I like to think of Grand Theft Auto as a crime simulator. Yeah. So if you've ever wanted to commit a crime, Grand Theft Auto is the game that you pick up to explore that part of yourself
safely.
But I feel like it affects my driving. Like when I play enough Grand Theft Auto and then I get in a car, I'm like, imaginatively, I'm at an intersection. I say, I can actually go on the sidewalk. You know, I can see the way that it sort of begins to affect you. But it's also, these are complicated discussions, because then you're like, is it, you know, if people do commit a crime, is it because, you know, can we draw these causal connections or not? And, wow. You know, certainly it allows you to explore.
Well, I'm going to be careful around the intersections of Hyde Park now.
It does explain a lot about Chicago drivers.
I think a lot of them, and the popularity of Grand Theft Auto. No, but I mean, I think, and on a sort of similar but note, but that takes us in a different direction, I think one of the things that we've all been gesturing to so far is the sort of immersion of playing, of getting sucked into this narrative, into these worlds, whether they're kind of calling us to a path of kind of meditation, or working through some emotion and catharsis, or working through violence, or and I think maybe here Alirza and I can tell you a little bit about this project that is more about thinking together about representation and the way that religion gets represented in the service of these in the service of these narratives, and in a way that propagates certain binaries about particularly Islam in the Middle East that sort of reinforce stereotypes in a way that can be dangerous, especially given how popular gaming is. So you only got half of the story in the intro. So gaming as an industry is bigger than the movies, music, all three of the most popular sports in the world, and books. It is the biggest, it dwarfs Every other form of entertainment that we have created is dwarfed by gaming. And a lot of gamers are consuming these texts, and some of them are buying these small indie games, some of them are playing Grand Theft Auto, but a lot of them are not thinking about the images that are being thrown at them. And so one of the goals of our project was to create these videos to help people who might be gaming to think about specific kinds of stereotypes in games. And because we're both from the Middle East and kind of this is what we're interested in, we wanted to think about how Muslims and Islam are represented in video games, especially games like Call of Duty that are set in these nebulous Eastern countries where, you know, you can shoot veiled women, and they're just characters to shoot. They don't have personalities. They don't have emotions. You are the only person as the soldier who does. and everyone else doesn't matter, in a sort of more disturbing way than in Grand Theft Auto. So that's kind of the impetus for the project. We'll be happy to talk more about this, but yeah, there's a dark side to the representation of religion in games. It's not all the sort of catharsis of working through something.
Everyone's so nice. No, I've played in quite a few games with some upside down crosses and bodies everywhere. Like you grew up on Tolkien, or Tolkien was a formative thing. I've read fantasy, but most of the books that I really enjoyed were like Dean Koontz, Stephen King, so more closer to that area, which I, found those really interesting at the time. Were they nice and fuzzy? No. But I play the kind of games that have that sort of, that genre, right? And in those, like you can have some really negative experiences, to your point, which is why more stories like, what the project that you're working on absolutely need to be represented, because as big as the gaming industry is, encompassing all of those other industries, it still suffers from a monoculture. Mm-hmm. So we're hearing the same stories over and over again. We have the same insensitivities that we see toward different types of people over and over again. And it's like, all right, cool, can we do something else? And can we add to that? Like, I'm not even trying to fight it anymore. It's just giving opportunities from some new experiences, fresh perspectives, fresh stories. Like, I what if I could play a game that would give me, more insight on, a group of people that I, as an American, am not exposed to every day, like where I can like be immersed in a way that allows me to explore that, as an individual. So we have way too many games from a homogenous sort of perspective in game development and game writing. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons that this is also really important, this kind of monoculture, as you point out, is that games are not just for playing. They do a lot of other things. You might have heard the term gamification. So the way that gaming is now built into all kinds of other aspects of our lives, including if you're learning a language with Duolingo, that's a very gamified app. If you're using various apps for going on a diet or for exercise, there's ways of gamifying that. For consumer, for buying things, there's gamified practices through which you're just made to buy more and more things. So it's disciplining us in particular kind of ways. Games are doing that. There's ways in which they're being deployed for buying things, for consuming things. And they're also being used in all kinds of political ways. So, the games that we played, for instance, it's not insignificant that the version of the Call of Duty game that we played in the 2019 game, how much did it make? It made $1 billion in a month.
In a month.
And then the second version, and then the 2021
version made $1 billion in 10 days.
In 10 days. But it's not, of course, the game is not made by the military, but it's used by the military for recruitment. And it's no accident, it's a massive game, a massive part of popular culture. So recognizing the kinds of ways that games are problematic also says something about the ways that these are working in our world beyond just as entertainment.
And cannot be ignored.
I think as a sort of big picture conceptual place to end, that's really important because, some of us are, I've spent my life learning about studying religion, so have you. And I think we often find that it's easy to imagine religion as purely kindness, niceness, that there is some universal core that's good, and that when things are bad or complicated or dark, that that's a sort of violation of religious ideas. And in fact, the more you study, the more you discover that religion, thank goodness, is far more complex than that. However you define it, it's really woven through with all kinds of darkness and negativity and possibility and beauty, sometimes right next to each other. And so it's really cool to think about gaming and religion as kind of connected in that way, not binary, far more messy, far more human, I think, in a really lovely way.
We'll be right back. Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.